One cannot choose but wonder, will he ever return? It may be that he swept back into the past and fell among the blood-drinking, hairy savages of the age of unpolished stone, into the abysses of the Cretaceous Sea, or among the grotesque saurians, the huge reptilian brutes of the Jurassic times. He may, even now, if I may use the phrase, be wandering on some plesiosaurus-haunted oolithic coral reef, or beside the lonely saline lakes of the Triassic Age. Or did he go forward into one of the nearer ages, in which men are still men, but with the riddles of our own time answered and its wearisome problems solved? Into the manhood of the race? For I, for my own part, cannot think that these latter days of weak experiment, fragmentary theory and mutual discord are indeed man's culminating time. I say for my own part, he, I know, for the question had been discussed among us long before the time machine was made, thought but cheerlessly of the advancement of mankind, and saw in the growing pile of civilization only a foolish heaping it must inevitably fall back upon and destroy its makers in the end. If that is so, it remains for us to live as though it were not so. But to me, the future is still black and blank. It is a vast ignorance, lit at a few casual places by the memory of his story. And I have by me, for my comfort, two strange white flowers, shriveled now, and brown, and flat, and brittle, to witness that even when mind and strength had gone, gratitude and a mutual tenderness still lived on in the heart of man. The closing lines from this romantic, fictional narrative, which in itself is significant from the point of view of the question of time, written in 1895, now over 120 years old, in terms of how we actually perceive that, how we would actually see the language that's being used and so on. And since we last met here 7 days ago, you may well have actually travelled in a metaphysical sense all the way up to the year 802,701 and beyond, and back again in about 90,000 words of text. It's often said that thinking is the best way to travel. So what is it about this particular iconic aspect of science fiction that really opens up one of the fundamental elements of science fiction in general, the narrative trope that is to do with time travel? How do we relate to it? How do we obviously see the kind of cultural images, many of which we see on screen at present, from obviously the George Powell 1960 version of The Time Machine, the Guy Pearce 1995 Time Machine, again produced by H.G. Wells' own grandson, Simon Wells, who actually was responsible for developing that, and the thoughts and the ways in which things are developed within that. There are a number of key areas that come across in The Time Machine that really start paving the way for discussion, discourse, and so on. And let's look at some of the negatives first. One of the critical ones, which probably comes across in the extract I've just read for you to actually introduce this whole essence, is the highly sexist language that's actually used. Again, viewed from our 21st century perspective, there are only two female characters in the entire narrative. One, of course, is Weena, the Eloy, who is so grateful that she's been rescued from drowning, that effectively she kind of becomes almost a pet of the traveller, as he kind of sort of connects with her and so on. And we actually hear that line of the two flowers that obviously she stuffed in his pocket, that he still kind of carries with him as a kind of memento, a souvenir of that time. And of course, the other character in The Time Machine, who's female, is... yes, Mrs. Watchett. Again, fairly sort of standard line there. Mrs. Watchett, who waits, housekeeper, and connects from that point of view. Other than that, it's arguably a very masculine-driven text. And yet, is that necessarily intrinsic to someone's appreciation or not? Characters are stereotypes. They are ciphers. Even the traveller himself, we never actually know his name. It's interesting that in the radio adaptation of the Time Traveller, there is a conceit that Highland is indeed H.G. Wells himself. He's the one who's kind of narrating the whole notion of the traveller and his journeys, etc. Does it fulfil what we talked about last week in terms of Arthur C. Clarke's notion that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic? Well, yes, there's no real essence in terms of how the travelling machine works, apart from obviously the traveller himself actually having the device to effectively, almost like a screwdriver, push it forward, push it back, and so on. And that's the sort of motion of the travel through time. But what is that actually kind of underpinning? What sort of statements are we actually seeing within this whole area? One of the questions in the sort of handouts, which we alluded to here, but there's a challenge with respect to technology, is what is the significance of the statue of the Sphinx? When the traveller travels to the far future, there are a number of key areas. We kind of see this revisited in future weeks dealing with time when we look at Ballard's Drowned World. And again, the notion of archaeopsychic time that comes through within that. But the whole notion of Sphinx in itself carries with it connotations of another ancient, long ago empire, the Egyptian Empire, the mystery of the Sphinx. The Egyptian elements that come across there. Nobody really kind of quite appreciates what the pyramids were there for, how they were built, how they were constructed. Okay, they were held as tombs, they were certainly uncovered and subject to theft and vandalism over the years. But again, they were very much part of our long-standing history. And yet, that whole notion, again, the reference to history that we actually see in the closing sequence that I was reading there, his story, her story, and so on. The line, of course, in terms of inevitably falling back in terms of history. You could argue that it's a very dystopian text. It's one in which, for all of the apparent success of Victorian England, and the notion of where things are developing and the success of this at the turn of the century, millenarianism coming across, obviously, almost, or certainly the end of the century in terms of 1895 to 1900, you could argue that it's seen very much as a text which says, well, actually, all things must pass. Everything will turn to dust, including, of course, a scene which isn't really alluded to in the novel, but is very much a poignant part of the filmic text in 1960. The actual books themselves in the museum simply crumble to dust. They're not actually, they're seen as ephemeral. And of course, there is the classic concern of how does the traveller perceive the future? Initially, the life forms that we come to know as the Eloi apparently have it made an Eden-like existence. And interestingly, the traveller himself uses the term communism. Now, on an ideal basis, communism, and obviously it hadn't, when Wells had written the text, actually impacted to the extent that there was a revolution in Russia to actually develop communism as a working, living system. It had been talked about and written about by Karl Marx in Das Kapital. There was the sense of an equality in society and so on. There is actually an arguable, well, a very good case for saying, well, actually, for Christians, Jesus Christ is surely the first communist. You're looking for equality. Equality of opportunity, equality of society, and so on. And yet, I think it's fair to say when you read the sort of way it's just a throwaway, it's just meant one word mentioned once. I don't think Wells is necessarily a proponent of that particular aspect. In fact, it's a little difficult to actually see what he's looking to get at throughout the whole piece, other than, as I say, a Darwinian fantasy. We looked at it last week in terms of the notion of, well, left to billions of years of evolution, or even hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, that's not as billions, these are some of the things that will actually happen. And if you have a situation whereby in Victorian England at the time, the notion of the underground, only in London, sort of building of things, etc. There are lots of cases you can look back of collapses of tunnels and so on, but the sort of notion of living underground, subterranean, it's not too much of a leap of the imagination to see a situation whereby you get a split in society between those who actually live above the ground and those who effectively have to eke out an existence below ground. In terms of diet and nutrition, it would seem that the Eli very much are vegetarians, or fruitarians, actually. And although it's never explicitly said that the Morlocks are cannibals, there is that implication that effectively the only way in which they're getting meat is basically by capturing and farming effectively the Eli, kind of cattle. It's a supposition. It's never actually made absolutely explicit, but it is actually made as a supposition through the text and so on. So does it actually help matters that when you see and you read and you appreciate what's happening in the time machine, you don't really get to know the characters? I mean, arguably the time machine itself is as much a character as the giant crabs at the end of the text, is as much a character as Wiener and indeed the Traveller himself from that point of view. But does that really matter? Because it could be argued that science fiction is all about the big ideas. It is, as Stephen Baxter said last week in the video clip that we actually saw, a text which actually blows him away from first reading, second reading, and subsequent readings. And I would certainly say, if you like or would like to sort of see the take that Baxter took, then get hold of a copy of The Time Ships. It's much, much more substantive a book. Probably takes 2 or 3 days to actually work through, effectively, as opposed to an afternoon, as in the case of The Time Machine. But he does start unpicking a number of things and asks that question which Wells never really addresses, which is basically causality. He goes back to the future, he comes back out of the future, and so on, and there is the notion of how he has travelled in time but not in space. Because the only way in which the space has actually travelled is when his machine has actually been moved in by the Morlocks and brought in as a trap in many ways for the traveller. That whole notion of, well, can you actually travel in time without having impacts in terms of society and so on? Do we ever find out what happens to Wiener? You know, we see, essentially, we read that she's apparently lost somewhere. Does she still live? What's the connection with respect to that? And so on. And the very notion that, as I say, from our narrative time, the whole thing takes place literally, if you're reading it from 1895's perspective, over the course of a week, 7 days. From when he first actually sort of demonstrates the model of the time machine to when effectively he comes back with a different sort of experience 7 days later. And the only other sort of aspect that we see is the small working model, which somehow has kind of found its way back, together with a sort of general description of the sort of messages that he's coming across, and so on. So one of the sort of general questions that we've put here, and again it's worth sort of considering, is given that the time traveller suddenly arrives in the year 802-701, how does that relate to 1895? Well, certain things are still there, in a sense. There is still the notion that London has changed, probably beyond most recognition, but there are certain key areas that come across within that. The Green Porcelain Palace, of course, being one of them, the museum and so on. But when we start talking about the Eli and the Morlocks, do we really find out about them? Are they sort of rounded characters? Again, probably not. Morlocks in particular. Again, Baxter actually takes that whole line in terms of the Morlocks and begins to explore and personalise that whole sort of aspect and actually sees them very much as engineers and developers within that whole system. And one of the questions that, again, we put in terms of this is it an uplifting story? Is it a kind of not really bothered story? Is it a story that you could be said as being anti-humanist? Well, either way, it ties in with the whole question of evolution. And you can certainly see that from the science fiction point of view, the science that he's playing with here is mostly the science of evolution. Time in itself is the vector. It's the way he actually uses that to actually travel from where we are to where we may be going. It addresses that what-if aspect. If we go on a little stage further and start examining the whole notion of the kind of tropes that actually gets there, it moves along at quite a rollicking pace. And hopefully, if you have managed to read it, you'll see that, you know, the sort of pace of the text is fairly brisk. It's the sort of thing which, if we look at the readership, yes, from a jobbing writer's point of view, it's going to be a page turner. You're going to want to find out what happened next. So it taps into that classic sort of notion, as an awful lot of writers were, of serialisation, novelisation, and so on. We're working through that. I'll show you hopefully later on today in terms of, you know, ultimately, he's not necessarily writing the time machine out of some grand notion of, well, I need to comment on this particular aspect. It's seen just as War of the Worlds, just as The Invisible Man, just as Island of Dr. Moreau, Things to Come, etc. were all written primarily because, you know, he wants to make a living, thank you very much. And interestingly enough, another sort of key element that also comes through is the writings of Arthur Conan Doyle, most famous for Sherlock Holmes. But Doyle himself developed the whole notion of the Lost World and the adventures of Professor Challenger in a much more sort of rigorous, again, dealing with time, but dealing with time's past. Again, returning to that excerpt that I launched the session with today. Lots of talks about the Triassic Age, the Jurassic period, etc. Pretty much at this time, folk kind of like had a couple of hundred years or so, less actually, to start thinking about deep time. Time over the passage of centuries. You know, the whole notion of terrible lizard, the literal translation of dinosaur, was something which, again, Victorians fascinated with. And obviously an awful lot of the development of the original archaeologists, paleontologists, study of bones, times past, etc., was at the heart of this. And as we know, we looked last week, Darwin actually himself came up with the theory of natural selection, primarily through his own voyage. But we talked about this one being a romance, a sort of science fiction that actually outlines the whole notion of romance and elements related to romance and so on. Well, you might argue that there's not a great deal of romance in the time machine. Or what there is, basically, it's a case of hardly reciprocated. But maybe it's actually that whole notion of generating the what-if, the whole aspect of how we see individuals relating to scientific aspects, exploits, and so on and so forth. Is Wells a romantic? Well, he certainly had some interesting views in terms of relations. He worked closely with a number of women from the Fabian Society, which was a left-wing think group that actually opened up a whole range of sort of ideas and so on. He had his own views on marriage and so on. But was he, again, talking from the point of view of wanting to lay down some key things? Certainly not to the extent of what we see later in Things to Come and other areas within that. But then the other aspect, which is very key to an awful lot of studies, is the classic structural dichotomy between utopia and dystopia. And something that is well worth considering insofar as you could argue that one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. In other words, the land of the Morlocks might be perfectly good for them. We don't really know. Likewise, the Eli. Likewise, both of them might be perfectly happy with the whole thing. And it's only the perception that we get from the traveller's viewpoint that suggests that actually this is a nightmare. This is a disaster. We certainly see the importance of fire and the input in terms of obviously keeping hold of your matches and not wasting your matches without actually sort of running through a sequence of saying, well, you know, running out of matches, because that becomes critical in terms of how we see the sort of advance being developed and so on. And the whole notion of the uncertainty about fire and flame. Now, you could argue that actually the discovery of how to control and use fire takes us all the way back to what we were talking about last week with Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus and so on, going down, coming back with the secret of fire, and so on and so forth. And if we think back to, again, that mystical notion of the Sphinx, what sort of character do we actually see within that whole field and so on? I mentioned the Sphinx. The other sort of architectural oddity that's there is the Palace of Green Porcelain. An unusual name because it almost suggests a kind of Middle Eastern Oriental notion from that point of view. The Palace of Green Porcelain. A number of times I've sort of read through the whole process. Sometimes I'll say maybe it's a kind of take on Crystal Palace. Maybe it's more a case of a combination of, obviously, and again he refers to the notion of South Kensington and so on, so therefore you're looking at the Victorian Albert Museum and the essence that comes within that of a substantial building that's meant to be a key aspect of how we would actually see progress being made. And progress in itself is quite an interesting contrast. You know, the notion of progress, that things will continually improve. We only see in the original printed narrative three particular time areas. 1895, 802701, and then some unspecified date far, far into the future, where in essence we've obviously got beyond the crabs, beyond more, again, life forms, and the death of the planet. So from that point of view, he doesn't really explore anything other than sort of the way that we've been developed. Is it prediction then? No. I think you need to sort of read it very much as the notion of how things are going. Again, if you contrast that, for instance, with the filmic version, then partly because it was produced in 1961, we see the Traveller actually emerging at the end of World War I, the Great War, during World War II, and so on, so there's a kind of notion of that. And certainly the characterisation, if you've seen the Guy Pearce incarnation at the turn of this century, again, you look at the Traveller dealing with the quandary of can he ever change time, can he use his time machine to go back to alter and adjust things, and so on. Again, standard narrative tropes that occur frequently within the foundation of what we call time travel and so on. So how can you actually read this then? Well, if you actually take it from a literary point of view, it's a classic structuralist cause célèbre in many ways. You have got past and future, present and future, Eloi and Morlocks, above ground, below ground. You have the notion of actually, yes, in terms of the binary opposition, the male-female, you could argue, would you see the machine itself? Would you assign a gender to the machine? It's possibly open for debate and so on. And again, you're playing around with, as in the words of the key structuralist Saussure, the difference between the two creating meaning and generating meaning. So you've got that whole element of how we actually see the machine operating and so on. Is there a hard science element to it? Do you have to actually understand chronological physics to appreciate it? No, you don't. Do you have to really appreciate evolution to appreciate it? No, I don't think so. And on that level, it does work very much as a text that, you know, if you come to it with no scientific preconceptions whatsoever, you can probably still enjoy it as a rollicking adventure, a romance in the same oeuvre as Jules Verne's Journey to the Moon, Journey to the Centre of the Earth, and so on and so forth. Except this is way beyond the moon. It's way beyond the centre of the Earth. But it doesn't actually leave the planet. So again, it certainly does not address any of the other areas that we will be coming to consider over the next few weeks. There are no robots. There's no sign of artificial intelligence at all. There's certainly no alien incursions or invasions. And there's certainly no deep space operatic elements entailed at all. So the sole thing it's actually dealing with in terms of what makes it science fiction would be relating to that whole essence of science fiction as time and, as I say, this whole question of evolution, how it's working, and so on. It's been described as a novel of specific and powerful contradictions. And again, one of the key questions is, does it actually offer any clear moral or didactic message? That's going to be open for our discussion. Perhaps you could argue that you need to ensure that humanity needs to relate to each other as aspects of a one unity or unified whole to succeed. You can't see a sort of situation emerging if you do specifically have an underclass or technical class. And again, it's still a little bit unclear in terms of, are the Morlocks in charge? Are the Eli in charge? Is neither group actually in charge? Is it just the way they are? Have they actually effectively devolved? You know, Darwin was very much of the belief that evolution was a natural progression, which normally means improvements, hence survival of the fittest. If you don't happen to have the right kind of characteristics and you can't adapt to a situation, you will become extinct. Clearly, both the Eli and the Morlocks reach some stage in the far, far distant future where they do become extinct. But we don't quite know how long they've actually been in their present situation. And so we know that year 802701, but that might as well be 603104. It's so far, far advanced. I mean, here we are in the year 2019, 2019 AD, Anno Domini. Dial back about 3,000 years BC, you've probably got total history range of 5,000 years. 5,000 years, not 800,000 to 100,000 years. So massive, massive amounts to actually consider that and to compress. You know, it's kind of inconceivable. You know, we can break time down. We often do, as I said. 168 hours ago, we were just introducing the whole notion of what science fiction was in this room. And in that 168 hours, everybody has had a different narrative, has had a different tale. Many of you might have been on thought experiments. It's often said that thinking is the best way to travel. And I'm not going to go into astral travelling, etc. at this stage. Although, it's worth noting that that's exactly what occurs in the 1960s with a new breed of science fiction writer, particularly led by Ballard and company, who want to start dealing into actually time is what is internalised. It is an illusion. But ultimately you start beginning to appreciate what time is on the basis of, does this lecture scene is going to go on forever and ever? Or is it compressed? Where are we? You know, everybody has their own internal circadian rhythm. Circadian basically coming from the around the day. Pop question for you to start off with. What is the difference between solar time and sidereal time? I've never heard of sidereal time. What the heck's it? Anybody got any ideas? Okay, solar time is basically the time it takes the Earth to do one revolution around the sun. It's how we actually measure time at present, solar time, split up into roughly 24-hour-long segments, and so on. Sidereal time, spelt S-I-D-E-R-E-A-L, as in sidereal, sidereal time, is the time it takes our solar system to revolve once around the centre of the galaxy. And depending on what you're looking for, it's where you get calculations of light years. Light year is the distance it takes light to travel over the course of a year. Perhaps how fast light travels, the speed of light. It's one of the reasons why, if you're not in a light polluted environment, when you look up at the stars, and again it's something that the traveller actually refers to in the time machine, that obviously thousands and thousands of years have gone by because the position of the stars have changed. The stars that we see on an evening now are probably not in existence at our moment in time. What we are seeing is what they looked like thousands of years ago, because it's taken that long for light to get to us. So there's the high science. It's one of the reasons why you can play around with that in terms of saying, so actually when you're looking up at the sky, you are looking back in time. Back in history. Narrowing it down, if the sun blinked out now, we would not know about it until 8 minutes have passed. It takes 8 minutes, basically, for the light from the sun to reach us on Earth. Now, those are things which have been theoretized and put together, and Wells certainly again alludes to that, because as I say, it's that although he could recognize the Milky Way, he could recognize the sort of the general outline, getting a sort of pitch on where the Great Bear was, Orion, and so on, that was beyond this whole notion. So both the traveller and the reader are parachuted in to this environment, which is still on the same planet, but it shifted in time, and positionally, in space, it's kind of stayed the same, or at least the machine has. It's just the time is upset. And that's ultimately why, as I said, you can draw another parallel between another Edwardian gentleman-ish in terms of tropes, or Edwardian character, let's say, these days, who still, you know, is manifestly hugely popular from 1960 to the present day, and that is, of course, the Gallifreyan half-human traveller, the Doctor. So a lot of sort of areas within that that you can also draw a sort of parallel between. And there was actually one episode written by Glenn McCoy in the 1980s in which the Doctor, played by Colin Baker, actually encounters H.G. Wells in an episode called Time Lash, and they sort of play around with the Morlocks and the Eloi and various other sort of elements within that. And Glenn, who prior to that had written a number of episodes of EastEnders, was very keen on developing that, spoke to him about what he was looking to do. It was very much a homage to what he saw very much as a fundamental aspect of this whole time-travelling system. There are lots of other areas of time travel which work with Back to the Future, clearly, the time tunnel, variations on the theme, etc. Even those of you who actually sort of follow the Avengers Endgame, it plays a whole round with the whole notion of where time is, how things are worked through, and so on and so forth. So it's undeniably one of the foundation pillars of what we appreciate as science fiction and so on. Okay, let's go on to consider a couple of other sort of bits and pieces whilst we're still around from this line of things, etc. This is quite a damning indictment of Wells, which I really want to sort of open up to discussion a little bit more. And it's this question about his opponents in the literary establishment in the sort of second page, considering him basically being vulgar. And the whole essence of Wells and what we're seeing here being something which is horrid, vulgar, and lacking in taste or aesthetic judgment. Now, I think it's fair to say that if you wrote that in terms of essay feedback, you're saying, bastard, what have I done? But I just want to spend a little bit of time just considering some of the sort of key things that come across within that in terms of, does it actually work? Or is it a case of when you're working through this whole essence, you're getting to the stage, you're thinking, yeah, well, you know, why can't you just get a ray gun or something, or zap them or something from that point of view? Any thoughts, Tony? First of all, did you read the text? Okay, good. That's just an audience, actually. I mean, that's not the essential. It's nice of you. Did you enjoy it? Or was it one which you thought, oh, Lord? What did you think?
I mean, I enjoyed it in the sense that I can wear the theories.
I mean, again, I think that's right. I think what you got here is a writer who, unlike Ursula K. Le Guin, unlike Anne McCaffrey, unlike Naomi Alderman, unlike many writers, kind of tends to focus more on the big ideas, which on the one hand does carry with it that wow factor, but on the other hand, yeah, I mean, again, Wells' opponents and the literary establishment considered him to be horrid, vulgar, and lacking in taste or aesthetic refinement. Has he left a negative legacy? And what I'm trying to get at here, and the line about that is one of the reasons that it took science fiction as a literary genre nigh on a century to kind of start getting away from this notion of being seen as a juvenile action-adventure genre not too dissimilar to the Western and so on. Is Wells at fault as a result of that, or is it a case of no, he's moving on now? You're shaking your head, you say no.
I mainly just think back to when they started broadcasting War of the Worlds on the radio in America, and everyone thought it was real, and they thought aliens were invading, and they were losing their minds. And I think for literature to actually be able to convince people when it's, you know, spoken in such a way, I think it actually expands the category of science fiction just from the people that look into it, to like everyone. I think a lot of films, like not necessarily in the sci-fi category, actually incorporate elements and tropes from sci-fi now. And I think I think it just sort of like help push that out. So I don't think it's done a bad job.
Okay. And it's worth noting it wasn't actually H.G. himself, it was his namesake and no relation, Orson Welles, on the Mercury Theatre Company, who actually did the radio version of War of the Worlds. And it was played on the basis of it was happening there and then. So the Martians had actually invaded and so on. So again, that notion of science fiction preparing us for the future.